Tina, Frankie, I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri, and I am amazed by Stonehenge, the logistics that was involved with moving boulders of that size and positioning them in such a way, it just boggles my mind.
Right, Stonehenge. How did that happen? You would need an army of Bigfoots to raise its giant stones. Do you have a favorite place or object of mystery from ancient or modern times? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The mother lode of ancient mysteries is what happened to the lost city of Atlantis.
Is Atlantis everything dreamed of?
Save our planet, Justice League. They, of course, knew all about Atlantis, the lost city described by ultimate egghead Plato a long time ago. Plato, who was right about everything else, said Atlantis was lost forever, sunk to the bottom of the sea, perhaps the victim of its own tragic hubris. But Plato left out a lot of detail. And author Mark Adams, in his book Meet Me in Atlantis, tries to fill in some of that detail with the hope of stumbling onto the real evidence of Atlantis. He discovered, like many before him, that Atlantis is a journey, not a destination.
Well, everybody I spoke to, and I should say everyone who was willing to talk to me, because a lot of people, a lot of archaeologists, anthropologists, historians, they won't touch Atlantis with a 10-foot pole. It's kryptonite because it's bad for your career. Mm. But those who I spoke with who were willing to discuss it said, you know, find the kernel of truth in what is essentially a myth, and then you'll be able to determine how much of the story is true. And, you know, there seemed to be some historical elements. There was some sort of cataclysm, which may have been a tsunami rather than an entire island falling under the sea. There was almost certainly some sort of naval war between Athens and some other entity. And there seems to have been an actual maritime city of some sort that Plato based this on.
And the Pillars of Hercules.
Yeah, and, you know, the most famous Pillars of Hercules were, of course, the Straits of Gibraltar. And I think that's probably what Plato was referring to, although other people have different theories. And as you look at all the various Atlantis theories, you notice that people tend to bend the evidence in the direction of the location that they've chosen for the possible site.
Who were the most famous sort of, you know, believers that they'd found Atlantis? And do you think they were crackpots, or do you think they were well-meaning anthropologists of another era?
Well, it depends. You can go all the way back to, you know, Plato founded the first university, the Academy in Athens. And one of the second generations that came after Plato died, a fellow named Crantor, a famous commentator on Plato's dialogue, he believed it was real. For a long time, the idea of Atlantis died out. And then in the 19th century, a fellow named Ignatius Donnelly, who was kind of a crackpot, he was a U.S. Congressman from Minnesota, you know, he found some of the first scientific data about mountain ridges on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean and used that to make these incredible extrapolations about Atlantis having been in the Atlantic, which is why most people, if you ask them right now where was Atlantis, they'd say it was in the Atlantic Ocean.
Why do you think Plato spent so much time on Atlantis? I mean, there's certainly some evidence that Plato loved to play practical mathematical jokes on his students. And if we're to believe that he's done this to all of civilization, there's one smart guy.
Well, the thing about Plato is we're still figuring some of these things out. And what initially attracted me about Atlantis was that the story appears between the Republic, which is arguably the most influential work in Western civilization, and the Timaeus, which is Plato's attempt to explain the universe and one of the most influential books, certainly in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, hugely influential on everything from physics to Christianity. In between those two works, you've got the story of Atlantis. So obviously it meant something to Plato. Exactly what it meant, I don't think we can tell. As best as I can guess, it's sort of a story that invites you to engage with his philosophy. It's sort of a crack in the door to suck you into some stuff that is really not easy to wrap your head around.
Or we interrupt these two chapters in the most brilliant philosophy in all human history to present some balderdash.
It's possible. It's possible. But, you know, why would Plato insert it at the beginning of the Timaeus, which is a very, very important work to him? To me, it doesn't make any sense. Also, he repeatedly says, and we have to figure out whether he's being serious or not, you know, this is a true story, this is a true story, this is a true story. Whether he is, you know, saying that ironically, we can't tell from this vantage point.
You know, Plato is a crazy kind of character. I mean, if you try to glean what it must have been like to be one of his students, I mean, there are places in the dialogues where he actually believes that reading is awful.
Yeah.
And in fact, that if civilization adopts reading, it's headed for disaster.
Well, this is a time when written history is basically a new technology, and that's part of the story as well. You know, I mean, Socrates in another dialogue says, you know, I don't believe in writing because you can't argue with it. And the question about Atlantis is this something that was passed down as oral history? You know, Plato says he got it from an esteemed ancestor who was, you know, Solon, who was kind of like the Thomas Jefferson of Athens, who got it from hieroglyphics in Egypt. Does that mean it was passed down as oral history, or did he just make that up because he thought it was a good story? And up to this point, there have been two opinions on Atlantis. He either made it up or it's all true. If you believe it's all true, you're crazy. If you believe he made it up, you're probably a tenured professor somewhere. You know, the truth probably lies somewhere in between. He made some of it up, and some of it was actually based in oral history that was passed down to him. That's part of the whole argument that Socrates makes in the other work. It's, in the Republic, he says, aren't there stories that are true and stories that are false? Well, what if there are stories that are part true and part false?
The truth lies somewhere in the middle. What do you believe? What do you believe?
What do I believe? I believe.
What do you believe?
I believe there is a kernel of truth in the Atlantis story.
So
I don't think
there's some jug somewhere, some pillar, some crumbled building somewhere.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Can you imagine if they found some sort of inscription? And like I said, all of this supposedly comes back all the way back from Egypt. What if they found some inscription, you know, in the Valley of the Kings or something? I mean, it would be the biggest news of the year. It would be like there is some sort of proof of Atlantis. Every time even the smallest little, you know, even hint of Atlantis, they found some orichalcum, you know, a few weeks ago. This was in the news. Somebody found some metal in the Mediterranean that might possibly have some sort of relation to the metal that Plato mentions was in Atlantis. You know, if they could find that plus a three-ringed city in the Mediterranean, I think we would have a very strong indication that there's a lot of truth in this story.
Look at you. You've got the bug.
It's a virus, man.
Oh, that's great. Mark Adams, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Adams is the author of the new book, Meet Me in Atlantis.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.